In an effort to lessen distraction to others and to respect our speakers, we ask that you please take a moment before to silence and put away your cell phones and other electronic devices. In addition, we ask that you only have kosher approved food and drink to respect our host, the temple. My name is Ivory and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Beacon Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organizations, or institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place so all who wish to recover from alcoholism, Therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA safety card and safety in AA, our common welfare. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Lily will read the steps. Hi, I'm Lily. I'm an alcoholic. I was roped into this by Amanda. Right. Here are the steps. Wait, is this where I start?
Just start.
Okay, here are the steps. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, do we have to say the numbers? Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thank you, Lily. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. All our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA's statements of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask all our speakers to identify by first name only and to refrain from using profanity. Tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Jenny.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jenny. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jenny.
Just going to lower this a little. Maybe not. Okay. So my sobriety date is April 1st, 2020. So God willing, I'll have 4 years in a few weeks. I have a sponsor. I have worked the 12 steps. I have a home group. And I am available to sponsor other women. Let's see. what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I come from a fairly loving family. nothing out of the ordinary. Great childhood, honestly speaking. I first picked up a drink when I was 14 in high school, and ever since then, honestly, I could say that's probably, you know, I think it's often come up where people are like, I wonder if I was born an alcoholic, when that happened. For me, like, I know from the first time I had a drink, that's when it started. I was a blackout drinker immediately from the get-go, and kind of that continued on until 30, which is when I got sober. Nothing, like, I mean, I'm not unique in the way, like, we became, you know, addicted to the alcohol, the feeling. There was, you know, I think when I went to... So 14 was drinking, and then kind of just continued on up until 30. It got progressively worse. There was a lot of consequences along the way. Got into a few car crashes. You know, ended up at the hospital a few times. But for me personally, I think nothing really... I got sick and tired, honestly, of just being sick and tired. I started realizing pretty quickly on, especially during COVID, I was waking up every day. You know, I was unemployed at the time. And kind of just in pajamas, drinking day in, day out. Not very unusual, but I decided finally, like I said, with the help of my therapist, she was like, I think you're kind of at a point where something needs to change. And like I said, my rock bottom wasn't necessarily anything really drastic. I could have very easily kind of just along the... first car crash, the hospitalization, anything kind of, you know, kind of woken me up, but I was just sick of the feeling. And that was kind of at the point where I was like, I need to make some sort of change. And I really wasn't sure what that change would be like. I tried independently, you know, for 5 months, maybe I got by myself, not really doing anything. I did other recovery programs that didn't necessarily work out for me. I would get a few months and then pick up. And I really realized that despite whatever the substance was, it didn't matter. Like for me, it was, I'll focus on the alcohol obviously, but anything I put, I got addicted to. So I just needed to like go the abstinence route. And so I decided with the help of my therapist who connected me to my now sponsor, to try AA out. And I think I was really hesitant at first because I felt like, you know, everyone, or at least my vision was that it was a very genetic disease, which I know it is true. But for me, no one in my family there was never any alcohol in the home or anything like that. And so I always assumed that it was a family thing. And so it was really important for me when I first started coming to meetings. I think I really wanted to distance myself from everyone. And I kind of was like, this is, you know, I don't have this issue, really separating myself from everyone in the group. And it was really when I started, you know, paying attention to kind of what was the similarities. You know, we might not have the same exact situations or family, you know, lifestyle or anything like that. But when you really listen to people's stories and focus more on the similarities, that's really when it started changing for me. And I started feeling a sense of more of a belonging. And I think in the beginning, I was doing like the bare minimum where I would just go to meetings and I would chat for a bit, and I realized nothing's going to change because AA really is, you know, it's a program of action. And I then decided, you know, to start working with a sponsor, the only person I knew in the program, because again, I was in and out of meetings for a bit, you know, connecting to the sponsor, working the steps, you know, kind of going through them all, making sure like the number one, I think I was the most important for me because like I said, I came in and was tired of just trying everything else and nothing else kind of worked. So I was at the point where I was like, I know that once I put a drink or a substance in my body, thank you, I can't stop. And there's something, you know, something that I can't do. And I learned, you know, through the time in the program that addiction, alcoholism, it's a threefold disease. You know, there's the spiritual malady, the physical allergy, and the mental obsession. And I think for a long time, I viewed it more so as like a character flaw, a moral flaw. I couldn't kind of get sober for anything, and it was really something that I could control. And so I think until I got here and I realized, you know, it's really, there's something, you know, I can't control this. And my life had become really disastrous. My relationships were awful. I was unemployed. I was not able to really, you know, I was not a great person, not living the life of, you know, I have values nowadays, and it wasn't aligning. I wasn't living the way that I wanted to. And you know, I did work through the steps pretty quickly, which, like I said, were really, they definitely were pivotal in, I think, here in AA, especially, to get through them. But I was desperate to kind of make a change. And I think in the beginning, especially, it was important for me to kind of, you know, get connected to different groups, to try different ones out, because all of them have, you know, different vibes, different experiences, and kind of really making an effort to stay connected to the people in the room. So kind of connecting with other fellows and sharing your number. You know, I really am grateful for those people. When I was a newcomer, that did make an effort to stay connected and to hear my story. And there was like genuine interest there. So that was, yeah, I think, important to hear other similarities. And yeah, what I'm like now, I think ever since getting sober, sometimes I think one of the things that I have a hard time seeing sometimes is people come, they get sober and life's great. And that's definitely not the case. I think it gives me AA and sobriety gives me tools to better handle things that, you know, are thrown. This has been a really, really rough few months for me personally, but I think staying connected to people and kind of, you know, using the tools of the program have helped me kind of get through it. I am very much a supporter of, you know, seeking outside support if necessary. I think, you know, with things that have been happening in my personal life, I could, if I were to pick up and drink, like, it would be not great. But nowadays I have, you know, a relationship. I've realized that I have, like, the values, and just being connected to, for example, like, my sister, who's, like, a really good friend of mine. You know, we've repaired our relationship completely. My family, they wouldn't be able to, you know, see me. You know, they wouldn't want to be in the room with me for a little more than 15 minutes. And so just, I think, being able to be an employee, a good friend, a good family member, it really is thanks to this program. And if it wasn't for AA and for everyone here in the room, I wouldn't be here. So that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. We will now observe the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. We are passing the basket, but you may also observe the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. There is a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. Although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, we do have expenses. Our rent is $200 per month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Megan, with any questions. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Robert has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Hi, I'm Robert. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible for those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Beacon Group is run by a business meeting, which meets on the third Wednesday of each month, directly after the meeting in person and online. This is your opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise their hands? And now let's welcome our second 10-minute speaker, Adam.
Finally, I've arrived. I'm filling in for Gannon tonight. I'm sorry I couldn't be here for you guys. I'm sure you wanted to hear him. I've never heard him share ever in my life in the 30 months that I've been coming around. I've been coming around 30 months. I've been sober and recovered for 21 of those. For the longest time, I just got to give a shout out to my current sponsor and my former sponsor, Corey, and that cute little Indian guy, that little Buddha there sitting right there, Jack. So I can start with my story from way back when, but I think the best place to start is when I walked into Beacon Group, actually, because that's when I found Jack. But that's also when I found a ton of resentment against this group. I'm not joking. I held a lot of that resentment like close to me. A lot of my default tendencies are to stew and marinate over things and to obsess. And those thoughts control me. They take me away. So much so that I'm able to take myself out of life if I let them go, you know? And that's what happened. I went away from Beacon Group for a long time, and I had to. There's a strategy that I found useful, which is like if something is triggering you, like if you're an alcoholic and you go into a bar and you're recovering from alcoholism, maybe you shouldn't go into the bar. Well, that's the approach I use for Beacon Group. It triggered me, and I had to leave. And then what I did is I did a lot of work. I did all the steps with a sponsor, and I practice all the steps. And it hasn't been clean by any stretch. But what it allowed me to do is come back to this group and accept all of you for who you are. You know, I came into this group projecting my experience onto you. You guys should have been something that I determined, you know. And if you didn't accept me how I wanted you to accept me, then I found a problem with that. And that was reason enough for me to leave. And I wasn't quiet about my objections, you know, to the Beacon Group. But here I am, you know, back again. Why? Because I've done a lot of work on myself, and I realized that all of my problems with the Beacon Group were about me. Like, I was the problem, you know? So it's now what I carry into this and what I carry into the world in general, whether it's meetings or with my wife, my soon-to-be ex-wife, with my son, it's really about showing up and how you show up. And if there are any problems, like Corey used to tell me, if there are any problems or if I'm disturbed, something is wrong with me and I got to look at it. So I don't have enough time to tell you everything, but I wanted to touch on a few things for you back there in the back row, just to engage you here. How much time do I have?
7 minutes.
Okay, I need 18 more minutes. So from like 12 years old, I turned inside. I was a different person. I was this outgoing kid. Actually, one of my friends just asked me this. I'm 44. He's like, you know, so I'm like halfway through life, right? He's like, what part of your life would you like relive again? You know? And I think he was expecting me to say, oh, 20s or young, early 20s, college. And I was like, no, 6 to 12. Like, that was my sweet spot. Like, I was so dialed in, you know? But the truth is, like, the answer is today, because I've never been more free than I am today, you know? Because when I was 12, I was this gregarious, outgoing kid, and then I turned inside, and everything became an inside, painful problem. I shared nothing with anybody. And that continued for 30 years, right? That's pain, but it's all self-induced pain, right? And AA, the big book, a sponsor, that's how I learned to kind of take what that is and turn it into something that's all right. Turn it into something that's my story. Turn it into something that I can relate to other people. Because that's the first thing I learned when I walked in here, is that I thought I had all the pain in the world that nobody understood. And as soon as I heard someone share my feelings, my thoughts, like, I identified. And so that's what I try and do when I share. I shared last night. I shared at BYP on Saturday, so I've gotten some practice being up here. And it feels good. And so if I'm doing anything today, it's sharing how I feel every single day with someone else. And that often involves me walking around the reservoir here at Cleveland Circle talking out loud like a crazy person, which is totally okay, right? Yeah. Although I hide in the woods a little bit sometimes. But like, I'm connecting with people. You like that one? I'm connecting with people all the time. And so slowly what's happening is that I'm shedding all these layers that I used as like protection against the world, because I didn't want you to see me, you know? I was scared to death that you wouldn't like me. I was scared to death that I wouldn't be accepted. I was also scared to death that I wasn't enough, you know? And that's a feeling that I felt up until today, really, you know, or recently. I did things because I thought I was in so much perceived pain that I didn't want to do. I got married against my will. I had a child against my will. I thought there was no way out. I thought the only way forward was through. I thought I had to carry the burden of this thing. I thought all of it had to be inside, and I couldn't share anything about what I was feeling on the inside, and that's just not the truth, you know? But it took the suggestion after hospitalization by a psychiatrist to say, hey, well, actually, it took me admitting that maybe I drank a little too much, just a little bit, right? And my psychiatrist at the time was like, maybe you should go check out AA. And so, you know, that simple admission basically has brought me to this place where slowly, 30 months later, 2.5 years later, I've got some freedom. I feel unburdened, you know, for the first time ever in my life. That's not something I want to give up. So, you know, for the longest time, I thought I didn't belong here. I thought, oh, you know, I'm educated. I have a career. I'm all this stuff that doesn't allow me to connect with you guys. Like it forced me to kind of the outside. You know, I wanted to be able to look down on everyone here and say, I'm not one of you guys. But now, like, the connections that I've made, the fellowship, you know, the friendships. It all just fills me with hope that I get to keep doing this thing over and over and over again, and I get to be more free every time I do it. I'm not there all the way. Yeah, I still got a lot of work to go, and it's slow for me. I had this idea about, I was listening to a speaker tape of this old guy, Sandy Beach. Maybe you've heard of him, maybe you haven't. He was talking about the ego. I had this idea about my ego and it being like a dog. And that I needed to kind of train my dog. And I needed to look at my ego as something that I needed to have in my life. And not something I'm trying to get rid of, but like a puppy that I'm, or like a child, like my son. I'm patient, I'm kind, I'm compassionate. It's also a way that I treat myself. You know, that's what I've learned here as well, is that I don't need to be fixed right away, right? Not fixed like a puppy, sorry. But like, I don't need to be cured. You know what I mean? Like, it's a long process. And I know, like, training my ego, training my dog is going to be, you know, a long journey. But like, investing in the journey, you know, that's the fun part, I think. At least that's what I've found. Like, I'm no longer feeling like, oh, fuck, I got to go to AA. I got to go to a meeting. I'm excited. Sorry for cursing. I know that's not allowed here. The ladies don't like it. I think that's about all I've got for tonight. Thanks, Adam, alcoholic.
Thank you, Adam. Oh, wait. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator, Ramiro, after the meeting. And now let's welcome our main speaker, Kim.
I'm not touching that.
Just pull it.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Kim.
I actually don't know how to do this. There we go.
There you go.
Is that good?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for asking me to speak. It's always an honor, and my sponsor always said I'm not allowed to say no, so I don't usually say no. But my sobriety date is October 7th, 1984. I joke and say I got sober at 10, but I was...
You're good.
Can you not hear me? Oh. Can you hear me? Okay. So I got sober at 18. That was not my plan. Anything I say is my personal opinion. And I believe that I was born an alcoholic, and the reason why I say that is because as a result of doing the steps and looking back throughout my life, I never felt quite right. I don't know what normal is, but I definitely was not normal. And I mean, even as a little kid, feeling like I just don't fit in, like everybody else had the book of life, they knew what to do, and I missed out, or I just wasn't given those things knowing what to do. Like, I didn't even know how to act, I felt like. And, you know, my family, my father was an alcoholic, I can say that, because he was self-admitted before he died. And, you know, my mom was not an alcoholic, she just tended to marry them. And so she had some stuff going on. And my parents got divorced when I was about 6 and a half. My brother was 1, and my mom left. And so I remember at that age feeling like I have to bring up this baby. Like, I'm going to have to teach him how to, like, potty train and talk and what. Like, I felt like all this responsibility at that age. And I had an older sister who was from my mom's first marriage, and she left not too long after my mom left. But that's just how I felt. And at 9 years old, which this appalls me, but I started smoking cigarettes. And I started smoking cigarettes at 9 years old and stealing from the neighbor. She had, I think it was a woman, I don't know, but I would go in her apartment all the time. She had this container full of money. Like, it was rolled up. She was probably a drug dealer or something. I have no idea. But, and I would, like, take a 20 out every once in a while, and I would go and give it to my dad because I thought that he needed money because he's trying to bring up my brother and I. And he's like, where'd you get this money? Oh, I found it. And on the street, whatever. And, you know, we moved a lot. And so I was always having to, like, change schools and find new friends. And I was really a good tomboy, and I just didn't fit in. But when we moved to Vermont, literally in the middle of the night because he couldn't pay the rent. So we, like, packed up our stuff. He wouldn't let me take all of my stuffed animals. I was very sad about that. And they were left in the basement of this house. And we moved to Vermont, and we were there for, like, 6 months. And again, it was just, my dad did the best that he could, and I know that. And he, you know, he loved us. When I got sober, I hated my dad, but I have been able to resolve that through doing the steps. And we had a house on Sebago Lake in Maine, and the summer going into sixth grade, we moved to Needham. And I didn't think that we were rich enough to live in Needham. And I definitely didn't have the clothes to live in Needham, is what my thought process was. I'm like, I'm not going to fit in and whatever. And that was the first time that I drank, was that summer. I had, like, drank nips and sips, like, from my dad's drink or whatever. But that's the first time I got drunk, was 11 years old. And it was the first time that I felt like my skin fit. It was the first time that I felt like, oh my gosh, this must be how everybody else feels. And I didn't drink every day or even every weekend that summer, I don't think. But I couldn't wait to do it again. And, you know, I chased that. And I had a lot of fun with drinking. It wasn't all misery. And I mean, I had a lot of fun. And at the end, it wasn't fun. But I just wanted to get drunk all the time. And, you know, I started school and, you know, water seeks its own level. And I found people that wanted to drink like I did. And Needham was a dry town, so that was kind of a bummer. So we had to go to Newton to get a buyer, to be able to get our booze. And, you know, I did other stuff in between. When I hit junior high, I picked my high school by how much drugs it had, because I really didn't like school. It was just a necessary evil. And I was just kind of skating by, procrastinating. I was getting in a little bit of trouble. I had to go to these classes. My dad had to bring me. My dad would find cigarettes, you know, in my pocket and put them in a glass full of water. So when I went down the next morning, my cigarettes were wet. And I'm like, I'll just steal another pack, but or steal money from him so I can get them. And, you know, I couldn't lower my standards fast enough. And when I was drinking, if I found somebody that I'd be like, oh my gosh, if I get like that person, then I'm going to stop. And then when I got like that person, I found somebody else who was worse. And I started to, you know, in high school, my friends were starting to be annoyed with me because I would just be drunk or high all the time without them. I didn't like need their permission. I just did not want to be in reality. And I ended up dropping out of school my senior year, and my mom had remarried, and moved to Arizona, and I had seen her a couple of times, but I decided that I wanted to move to Arizona to be with her. Really what I wanted to do was just leave Massachusetts and forget all of my problems. And so I told my mom that. My mom's an epileptic, and she didn't handle emotions well. So every time I would tell her stuff that was emotional, she would have a seizure. So in my mind, I caused my mom's seizures, which I know it's not true, but that's just how it was. So I told my dad I was going to move to Arizona, told my mom I was coming. My stepfather was like, what did you just say? Because your mom's having a seizure. And I'm like, I'm going to come live with you. And they lived in a one-bedroom apartment. So here I am going from a three-bedroom house to a one-bedroom apartment to sleep on the floor. Talk about settling for less. But I didn't really care. So I moved out there November of 83, and nothing changed. I brought myself with me. And so it was just the same thing, except for I worked, you know, I worked at a grocery store, and, you know, I just found people that like drink like me, and it was just the same thing again and again. I came back to Boston in June of 84, and drank that whole summer. I don't really remember a lot of it. And I got 12-stepped on a Friday afternoon in October. I actually got my license 3 days before I went to my first AA meeting. I drove drunk without my license, never mind with my license. So I'm grateful that I found Alcoholics Anonymous. And the person that 12-stepped me, he was a police officer in Needham and had been my neighbor. And he got sober. So my story, I used to say that he got sober in 82, and on his deathbed, he corrected me and said, no, I got sober in 83. I'm like, well, now I have to change my story. But so anyway, so he would see me, you know, walking drunk or whatever. And like I said, he got sober. So he would show me these, you know, chips that he would get. And I'm like, well, that's great for you because you're old. But, you know, I'm 18 and I don't want to stop drinking. Now, by the time I did get 12-stepped, I had tried to stop drinking. You know, I would have a bad night, and I used to think that I just didn't remember. And old timer in AA goes, no, honey, that's called a blackout. And I'm like, oh. And so Ted was, you know, kind of like putting seeds in my head, and I... Some girl from AA talked to me once, and in school I went to, you know, some sort of recovery meeting because my guidance counselor made me. But in my head, you know, the good alcoholic that I am, you know, I'm fine. I can do this. I don't really want to stop anyway, and if I wanted to stop, I would just stop because I thought that I was in control. And on this Friday afternoon, I was planning to come to Boston. I was hanging out with this guy who went to Wentworth College, and we were drinking those Heffenreffer. They have the puzzles on the caps. Could never figure those things out. But I didn't really care. I was just going to get drunk. And I walked into my counselor's... can I just grab my water? Sorry. I meant to bring it up with me, but I forgot. Excuse me. And when I walked in and Ted was there and my counselor, I'm like, you know, what are we doing, having a party? And they're like, yeah, you're it, sit down. So for the next hour, they proceeded to talk to me about my drinking and, you know, that I didn't have to live the way I was living. And I said, what's wrong with the way I'm living? And they're like, well, going into Boston and then missing the bus, because I would take the train from, you know, Newton Highlands, and I would always miss the bus coming out, and Ted worked midnight, so he would look for me and usually give me a ride home. So I'm, you know, forever grateful to him, because I was starting to put myself in more dangerous situations. So they talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, well, yeah, but that's for old men, and I'm not a man, even though I tried to be, but, you know, dressed, you know, whatever. And they're like, no, you don't understand. Like, you don't have to ruin your life. So I agreed to go to Needham Friday night. That was my first meeting. And I knew where it was because I used to smoke pot on the back steps. so I knew exactly where it was. And I can remember, you know, walking home and Ted said, you know, I'll meet you. And back then, the beginner's meeting was 7 to 8, and the speaker meeting was 8:30 to 10. And I drank two Budweiser talls, because my dad, even though I was 18, I wasn't 21, he was letting me drink with him. So I drank two Budweiser talls, and I walked up to the meeting. Because I really didn't, even Ted, he said he was sober, but I was like, why would you do that? Because the thought of not drinking really, really terrified me. Because I did everything with drinking at this point. And I didn't know how to not drink and live my life. So I walked up to the meeting and I was waiting for Ted, and, you know, the people were going into the meeting, and they're, like, trying to say hi to me, and I'm staring at the ground, and I may have had my fist clenched, because there are people who remember my first meeting, and they're like, yeah, you were a little scary. I'm like, I was a little bit angry. And Ted got there, and he's like, come on. And the door that we used back then, it was, like, literally walking down, like, this dark staircase, and I'm like, are you taking me? And he goes, just walk. And I walked into the meeting, and I hope I never forget this feeling, but when the door opened, I felt like I walked into a very safe, warm, loving place, and I felt hope. I didn't know that's what I was feeling. I was feeling terror at the moment, but, you know, looking back, you know, that's what I felt. And people were, you know, smiling and greeting each other and laughing. And, of course, I thought they were laughing at me because I'm self-centered. But I sat at the table because that's where, you know, Ted, you know, sat. I didn't say anything. I think I looked at the floor pretty much most of the time. And there were two people who had white hair, so gray. So I thought they were, like, the token, you know, like, in charge of the meeting. And Irving... he died sober a long time ago, but he was a magician, and it was his birthday, so I'll never forget. It was his birthday, and he was at a meeting, and I'm like, why would he be at a meeting if it's his birthday and there's cake at home? But I was able to hear that you don't have to drink, but I didn't think that applied to me. Thank you so much. I didn't think that applied to me, and... they talked about sponsorship. I turned to Ted and I said, oh, you can be my sponsor. And he goes, oh, no. No. So he pointed me to this woman and said, go ask her. And I'm like, I don't even know what I'm doing. He goes, just go ask her. I'm like, okay. So I go up to this woman and I say, oh, you know, will you be my sponsor? And she goes, sure. She goes, can I have your phone number? I'm like, what do you want that for? And she's like, okay. She goes, well, because we exchange numbers so that, you know, you can call me. And I'm like, oh, why do I want to call you? And she's like, oh, my God. So anyway, so we exchanged numbers. And I went to the speaker meeting. Somebody handed me a big book, this guy Andy. And he pointed out the promises, which was on page 449 in the third edition. And I just didn't understand. I think it was the only meeting that I sat through the whole time, although I can sit through a meeting now, but back then I could not sit through a meeting. And at the speaker meeting, there was a woman getting a year, and it took her 16 years to get a year. And another woman was getting 3 years, and she got sober at 19. So I kind of gravitated towards her a little bit. And I drank on Sunday. I drank on Sunday because I didn't know I wasn't supposed to. Literally, I did not hear that part. So my first drunk was on Fire Island, and my last drunk was on Fire Island because it was Columbus Day weekend, and that's when they close, you know, the ferry. So, and my dad had bought me beer because I didn't tell my dad I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on Friday night. But, you know, through the grace of God, you know, that was my last drunk. Till today. And, you know, I know some people will say, oh, I haven't found it necessary to drink. That's not my story. I have found it necessary to drink. I just didn't. Through the grace of God, through sponsorship, through picking up the phone, through, like, hanging on for dear life. There have been times in my sobriety that I thought I was going to drink and there was nothing going to stop me. And my car either ended up at my sponsor's house or at a meeting without my permission. So, you know, I know that my God works through people in this room. You know, and I went through a few sponsors and, you know, the whole, you know, we suggest, you know, get a relationship in a year. I go, I'm 18 and you're going to tell me I can't date. And so that first sponsor fired me. And then I got another sponsor and, you know, it just, I didn't follow all the rules, you know, except for I didn't drink and I went to a meeting and I asked for help. I didn't really believe in the whole God thing. So back in 84, they talked about light bulbs. You can use a light bulb. That's more powerful than you. I'm like, yeah, but they burn out. And my sponsor would just shake her head. And I had an answer for everything, apparently. And I went to, you know, step meetings, and they didn't do a lot of the big book the way they do now. You had to go to the Cape for that. I don't know why, but that's what you had to do. So, but I did go to the Gavin House through an AWOL, which I know is not Alcoholics Anonymous, but so I did round and about stuff. But I can tell you that, you know, I got married. I started having babies. I continued to go. I didn't go after I had my son. I didn't go to meetings for a little bit. My sponsor's like, I'm not your meeting, so you need to get to meetings. And I'm like, yeah, but I have this baby. She goes, yeah, you're going to drink if you don't go to meetings. So I'm grateful that she wasn't, you know, sugarcoating anything for me. And I was 15 years sober. I'm pregnant with my third son, and I wanted to take my car and slam it into a tree, and I did not know what was wrong with me. I was not happy. My marriage was not well, and that's when I started going to a woman's big book meeting in Natick, because I was going to a step meeting, but you couldn't bring children, so I knew I had to, like, do something. So, and that's where I met, you know, I knew the woman who became my, you know, sponsor to take me through the big book. And she was, when I first met her, she was the angriest woman I had ever met and wouldn't go near her. And she had changed as a result of doing the steps. So I had asked her, and I started going through the process. And it took me a little while to, you know, go through my four steps, because then I had a newborn and two other small, and excuses. I would use anything for an excuse. However, when I finally, you know, got through my four step, I was so pissed at myself, because I'm like, I could have, like, saved myself so much time had I done this sooner. And I found out the problem was me, which really pissed me off, because I was having so much fun blaming my husband and my kids and my boss and everybody around me for all my stuff. And it wasn't. It was me. And I can change me. I can't change anybody else. And a couple of years after that, I asked my husband for a divorce because I realized it wasn't going to work. And that was tough. But I didn't have to drink. And I wanted to. There were times that I wanted to. It was very emotional, painful. But, you know, today, you know, I've done another four step and a fifth step, and I'm continually working on myself. I am not perfect by any means. I got remarried to actually somebody who also got sober at Needham Friday night. You know, and today, you know, my life, this morning I woke up and I got down on my knees and I asked my God to keep me away from a cigarette and a drink, keep me sober and away from a cigarette, and I pray for people. I knew I was coming here. I actually fell asleep on the couch and I, like, woke up and I started at 6:15. I'm like, shit, I'm like, I have to, like, go, you know? So my cat's like, what's up, you know? So, then I was panicking. I'm like, the traffic, but I got here in plenty of time, obviously. You know, my life today is, you know, contingent, you know, on my spiritual condition, and I am constantly working on it. Some days are better than others. Last week, I was standing in my boss's office crying because I work part-time, and there's somebody that I work with that he's just not a very nice person to me. And so it's just kind of like this, it's not all about me, but I basically said to my boss, I'm like, I don't need this job, like, to eat, you know, and I don't want to live in high school all over again. But I had to look at myself, and it's not my business what other people think of me. And my sponsor tells me that all the time. but I'm very self-centered at times. And what I do for work is, you know, I'm a dispatcher, 911 operator. So, you know, it's pretty important. I don't know. So I don't know where I was going with that. But I know that, you know, today I'm not drinking. I get to see when I'm at work, you know, people that drink and, you know, not good things happen to them. You know, my sister, she died, we found her January 3rd of 2020, but she probably died, you know, December 30th or 31st, as a direct result, you know, of alcoholism. And I was really pissed off. I didn't want to go to meetings because I didn't want to hear, like, what people had to say. It was really difficult. But again, I didn't drink. You know, I mean, that's a pretty prime example, power of example, my sister was. She was in AA back in 88 for a year, and she had a really good job and stuff like that. She told me later, she goes, well, yeah, I didn't drink, but I smoked pot every day. I'm like, okay, I'm like, whatever, you know. But not everybody is going to get this program, you know. And I can remember my sponsor would say, you know, you'll walk over bodies. And I didn't really understand what that meant. And I definitely understand, you know, what that means today. I don't take this for granted. I am very fortunate that I get to live my life that I live today, sober. And I wouldn't change it for anything. You know, my three children, three boys, you know, 30, 28, and 23. The 23-year-old is 6'5", so he towers over me. And, you know, they've been to AA. They said, they're like, on your 40th, we'll give you your coin. And I'm like, so that's this year, you know, so hopefully, grace of God. But, you know, I'm saving a seat because I'm sure that, you know, one of them has got it. And I want Alcoholics Anonymous to be here, you know, for, you know, other people. And I'm starting to sweat. So I think, but I just want to read one thing out of Dr. Bob's nightmare. Because I read the chapter and it's just, I just really like the last paragraph that he, so if you don't mind. If you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you still think you are strong enough to beat the game alone, that is your affair. But if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and all, and sincerely feel that you must have some help, we know that we have an answer for you. It never fails. If you go about it with one half the zeal you have been in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink, your Heavenly Father will never let you down. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim. Now we have Mike and Angelica for festivities.
Hi, Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mike. Hey, Mike.
We have our business meeting after the meeting tonight, so if you want to meet some people, get involved, see how the group works, come stick around after the meeting. We'll do it right in this room. We also have two monthly commitments, the Hillside Detox. That's the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. and then the third Sunday of the month at 11 a.m. See anyone with their hands raised if you want to get involved in that. Thank you, guys.
Hey, I'm Angelica. I'm an alcoholic.
Oh, hey,
you guys are short.
There we go. Now I'm just gonna do this. Okay. The The Massachusetts State Convention of Young People in AA is going to be having their conference, our conference, August 16th through the 18th in Dedham, Mass. We also have host meetings the third Sunday of the month. And then we're having a camp out. I have flyers if anyone wants to know about it. That'll be fun. It's going to be June 21st through the 23rd. Because we have the business meeting, I'm not quite sure if we're going to do bar taco afterwards. We can reconvene. You're not going. We can reconvene afterwards. And then we do have our gratitude box. If you guys are grateful for anything today, you should write a little something something. It's going to be back there. I'm grateful for this meeting. I'm grateful for all of you guys. And I'm grateful for sobriety. So I should write something down. So thanks.
Thank you.
Like, you're short.
Sorry, I just have one other, well, two other announcements. My name's Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. We have two elections coming up for position for open service positions. The first one is going to be on Monday, April 8th, which is for the Beacon by the Book Monday night co-chair position. It's a 6-month position. Requirements to run for that position are that you have a minimum of 1 year of continuous sobriety. You're a regular attendee and active participant of the Beacon Group speaker meeting. You've participated in more than one rotation of the Monday night Beacon by the Book meeting. Just to name a couple of the requirements. If you'd like more information on that, you can see me or anyone with their hand raised. And again, that election will be held on Monday, April 8th. We'll also be holding an election for an open position on the steering committee at the end of this meeting on April 10th. The position opening up is for festivities and assistant jobs coordinator. It's a 1-year term. Anyone who is eligible to stand for steering committee is welcome to run for this position. A few of the requirements for eligibility include having 5 years of continuous sobriety, you've been an active member of Beacon Group for a minimum of 2 years, and have held a position as a group rep in Beacon. Those are a couple of the requirements. Again, if you are interested in standing for this position, you can see me or anyone who has their hand raised. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. And for Chips, we have Kelsey and Zubin.
Hello, my name is Kelsey and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Kelsey.
Take the book. Mm-hmm. This is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the basic text of AA. If you do not own a copy, please do not leave here without one. It sells for $12. Meeting lists are free, and other AA literature is available at cost. Please visit our literature chair after the meeting for more information. The Beacon Group marks milestones in recovery with chips. When you hear your time, please come up and get your chip. 18 months. Really enunciating. Mm-hmm. 11 months. 10 months? Oh, yeah. 9 months? 8 months? 7 months? 6 months? 5 months. Oh. Congratulations. 4 months. 3 months. And the most important chip, 24 hours to 29 days. All right, Zubin, it's all you.
Thank you, Kelsey.
You're very welcome.
Hi, I'm Zubin. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Zubin.
Sponsorship is the cornerstone of AA's 12-step recovery program. If you are new to AA or our group and you do not have a sponsor, we strongly suggest that you get one. Will anyone who is willing to speak to people about AA or sponsorship please raise your hands? Thank you. AA anniversaries are celebrated on the last Wednesday of each month. This is an opportunity for members to come and express their gratitude for a minute or so. We suggest that all celebrants donate $1 per year of sobriety to be sent to GSO, and of course, excellent cake will be served. To promote unity and enhance sobriety, Beacon Group organizes anniversary watches. This is an opportunity for Beacon Group members on their 364th day of sobriety to sit with their sponsor and friends beginning at 9:30 p.m. to watch their first year of sobriety be ushered in. Anniversary watches take place at the Brighton IHOP at 1850 Soldiers Field Road. If you're about to celebrate an anniversary, please see our anniversary chair, Brian, after the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Congrats to everyone who got chips. This has been a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are cordially invited to meet with us again and to become a member of our group. To be on our email list, please sign up with your name, phone number, and sober date at beacongroupaa.com. Please remember our custom of thanking our speakers. The line will form at the back of the room by the main exit. And now for those who care to join in the Lord's Prayer.
I'm slow.
That's Daniel.
Here we go.
Be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.
All right.
Keep coming. So do work.
Where is that?
Right in here. Yeah, we'll usually get it started.